Welcome to the CNGM podcast. I'm Pauline Helmsley-Vinson, Interim Director of the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. The CNGM podcast highlights the voices of contemporary Arab American writers. It is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and the Arab American National Museum. We open today's episode with Ghassan Abu Zainuddin reading from Hadha Baladuna, Arab American Narratives of Boundary and Belonging.
Hi, my name is Ghassan Zainuddin, and I will be reading from my essay and atlas of poems from the book Hadha Baladuna, Arab American Narratives of Boundary and Belonging. And I'll read a small section. The section heading is titled Portals to Lebanon. And this scene takes place in Dearborn, Michigan. And I mention Rana, and she is my wife. When Rana and I grocery shopped at the Middle Eastern stores, whether it was Greenland, aka Mustafa's, or Dearborn Fresh, aka Al Madina, as soon as we entered the front door, we were transported to a grocery store in Beirut from the first whiff of roasted nuts and coffee beans. There was also the smell of raw meat at the butcher's in the back. The bags of thyme, suma, bulgur, mughrabiyye, and fava beans stacked on metal shelves, the jars of pickled eggplant, radishes, and hot peppers, the strange yogurt and kashkaval cheese, the loaves of pita bread and boxes of gak, the ghandur biscuits and yunica chocolate, and the rani and chani juices that Rana used to drink as a child. As in Beirut, we'd catch the patrons sampling the fruits on display. They'd pick grapes or locots and eat them in the aisle. It wasn't uncommon to find olive pits left on the edge of the olive counter. As soon as we left the grocery store and a blast of icy wind hit our faces, we were reminded that we were in the Midwest. Many of the small businesses in the city that weren't outwardly Middle Eastern were owned by Middle Easterners, such that most of their patrons were Arab. Rana and I were always confused whether to speak in English or Arabic to the cashiers. Even American establishments like Starbucks were somehow Arabized, or should I say Dearbornized. When I entered the Starbucks on Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn, I often found a group of Lebanese men sitting in the leather armchairs in the main seating area, carrying on a conversation in Arabic over espressos, as they must have done in the coffee houses in the Middle East. Dearborn isn't America, Rana once told me. It's Dahi. High-rise buildings dominate the Beirut suburb. Its narrow streets crisscross above with electric lines. Marcher posters of Hezbollah soldiers are pasted on walls and street lamps. Yellow Hezbollah flags flutter from balconies and telephone poles. Although Rana grew up in Dahi, she attended the Lycée National and Saint-Joseph University, the latter a Catholic school founded by Jesuits in 1875, and previously worked in companies with no religious affiliations, so she never quite embraced the Islamic atmosphere of Dahi or the fact that most of the women, including her mother, wore headscarves. But she still dressed conservatively. There were eyes watching her every move, especially the neighbors. As frustrated as she was by Dahi, Rana accepted her reality because this was a side of Lebanon that wasn't going to change. When we began living in Dearborn, Rana had expected her life to change. I thought America was this place where I'd care less about what others thought of me. You do what you want, she said. But in Dearborn, I still worry that others are judging me. Rana particularly felt this way when buying groceries. The salespeople and patrons could tell that she was coming from abroad by the terms she used when she spoke. Sometimes saying kilos instead of pounds. When did you arrive here? They asked her, followed by, why'd you come here? They wanted to know her religion, to see if she was a practicing Muslim. Fortunately, Rana didn't feel the same way in West Dearborn, where we frequented bars without anyone judging us. Thank you.
I have the pleasure today of interviewing Ghassan Zainuddin. Ghassan is an assistant professor of English at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, the host institution for our podcast. Ghassan teaches creative writing and Arab American literature. He was born in Washington, D.C. and raised in the Arab world. His debut collection of linked short stories is titled Dearborn and is coming out in the fall of 2023 from Tin House Books. We're really looking forward and eager to see that. He's co-editor of the creative nonfiction anthology Hada Baladuna, Arab American Narratives of Boundary and Belonging. The other two editors are Nabil Abraham and Sally Howell. Sally Howell is also a professor at University of Michigan, Dearborn. Ghassan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me here, Pauline.
Yes, this is a nice change. Those of you who follow our podcast have heard Ghassan interview other writers, and it's fun and nice to have him be now sitting on the other end of the of the microphone.
Less work to do for me.
Yeah. Well, pleasure for me to read and talk to you about this book. So let's talk a little bit about this edited collection, Hada Baladuna, Arab American Narratives of Boundary and Belonging. Can you tell us a little bit about how the idea for this book was formed and how you and your co-editors came together and decided to do it?
Sure. Yeah. So I actually came to Dearborn, my wife and I came to Dearborn in fall of 2018. My colleague and friend, Sally Howell, who's a historian at University of Michigan, Dearborn, she approached me that fall of 2018 about perhaps working on a creative nonfiction anthology about the Arab American community in the Detroit metropolitan area. She and a few other co-editors had actually already had published a series of books about the Arab community in the Detroit metro area. It's the Arab Detroit series from Wayne State University Press. And they actually had two volumes that they had published already. And I believe this book, it had been 10 years since the publication of the last book. And in the previous two books, it was mostly primarily scholarly articles, but they did have creative works such as poems and few creative nonfiction essays. But with this volume, Sally had something different in mind, like more just solely creative writing. And I was really intrigued by that, to work on not just a book about the community, but to also work with local writers. That opportunity to work alongside them over a number of years, I found that really intriguing.
Yeah, that's really great. Yeah, one of the nice things about this book is the different voices. There are some accomplished writers, right, well-known names, alongside new emerging voices,
exactly,
that many of us didn't have the opportunity to hear before. So that's a really nice aspect to this.
It really is, right. We really wanted to have that in the book, like this conversation between emerging and established authors. And for a few of the contributors in this volume, it's their very first publication.
That's so amazing.
Right, yeah. For them to have that platform and to tell stories that they've never told before and to see their name in print, there's something validating about that for them. So yeah, that was really exciting also to see, you know, these emerging writers and kind of nurturing them and guiding them along.
Yeah, that's really terrific. And I have to say that as a reader, I really appreciated that and appreciated the way voices from the community are foregrounded, because Arab Americans generally and people in Dearborn specifically are often studied,
right?
They are studied by others, but it's important to uplift their voices as well as part of the conversation. So that was a really nice.
Yeah, exactly. And on that note, so I mentioned that previous two books in the series and how there were a lot of scholarly articles in those pieces. And they were commenting on themes that you find prevalent in this book,
uh-huh,
you know, in terms of like the personal and political, sexual orientation, immigration, displacement, exile. But in the other two books, it was more of a scholarly approach, where here it's all those themes are kind of embedded in these narratives.
Right.
It's all embedded in stories.
Yes.
So that gives it a very human touch.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. Given the combination of voices that you've brought together, what was your selection process? How did you decide who to invite or how to call through the submissions?
Sure. We had a call for submissions that was open to all writers via Submittable, but we didn't actually get many submissions, not enough. So at that point, we started soliciting writers. It was really cast a wide net. We reached out to writers in the local community to see if they'd be interested in contributing their work. So for instance, I remember one of the contributors, her name is Hanan Nasser, and the essay in the book is called Watan. She's actually my former student.
And
right.
Nice.
And I remember she was in my class and she wrote this really compelling essay about her Iraqi refugee experience. After the call for submissions, I thought, you know, I'll try to reach out to her to see if she'd be interested in really developing that essay into something much much, you know, larger. And she was really up for that. After the call for submissions, the editors and I really kind of went out and tried to recruit writers. And sometimes, you know, we got promises from contributors that they, yes, they would contribute, but they never did. So it was, there were a lot of moments where we were worried, do we have enough essays in the book? But then it turned out all right.
That's really interesting. And I love that story about a student of yours, because this is a work of mentorship as well,
right.
You know, which is really beautiful to see, you know, the way sort of organically
exactly.
working and right. nurturing.
I remember in our exchanges, I made a point in our communication to be almost like we're peers talking here. I'm an editor, you're a writer, not a professor.
Nice, yes.
Because you
exactly.
kept saying, Professor Hassan, you know, you don't have to call me professor. We're just working on this book together.
Nice. That's great.
Right.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, you mentioned this one contributor. Can you talk a little bit about some of the other contributors and some of the pieces?
Yeah.
I want to get to your piece at some point, but let's talk about some of the others. You mentioned Watan by Hanan
right.
Nasser, your former student.
Right. And I guess, so we were really after diversity of voices in the Arab American community. So that meant diversity in terms of Arab ethnicities and also diversity in terms of different professional backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds, different sexual orientations, different genders, obviously. So it was really important. If you're now living in Dearborn, it's so diverse in terms of the different Arab ethnicities. I mean, you have, yes, the Lebanese, but Iraqis, Yemenis, Palestinians, Egyptians. So it was really important for us to kind of capture a wide range of voices from all these different Arab ethnicities. And again, providing a space for queer voices, for voices in which, so for instance, there's an essay by Jeff Karoub, not Arab enough. One parent of his is Arab and the other is a non-Arab. So that essay really navigates what that is like. Is he, you know, the title is Not Arab Enough.
Yeah.
And the essay kind of interrogates that notion. Is he not Arab enough because he's quote unquote half Arab, or, you know, he doesn't really understand Arabic, or he's more comfortable at least speaking English. Similarly, May Jacobowski, her essay is titled On the Margins, Queer Arab American. And what's so compelling about this essay, she also, her father's Lebanese and her mother is non-Arab. So it's about this idea of whiteness and how Arab or how white she feels. Complicating that is her queer identity and kind of coming to terms with her queer identity. So I thought it had some similarities to Jeff Karoub's essay, but it also had this queer element.
Right. Yeah. And reading those essays, and I have read every one of them, they're compelling and really interesting, and each bring a unique voice, even when there are resonances and thematic continuities or parallels between them.
Yes.
And what I liked about those two is think of Arab American, the identity of Arab, as the outsider, right? But Dearborn, and I know you talk about that a little bit more in your own piece, it has its own little space. And now living here myself for the past few months, it really feels like it's its own place, and how that can be so safe and nurturing, but also for someone who doesn't quite fit in, how that can be the question of not Arab enough usually is experienced when somebody goes back to an Arab country,
right,
like somebody
right.
who's born here goes back to Lebanon or Syria, or but here it's experienced within the Arab American community.
Exactly.
I love the way those pieces express that through personal experience and how you've made space for that.
Right. And there's also an essay by Terry Bezzi. It's titled Urban Nomad. And in that essay, she tackles sexual assault, which, you know, which is a subject that is kind of a taboo subject in the Arab community.
Yes.
So she really gives voice to those who have been sexually assaulted and the importance of talking about the assault in order to kind of recover from it. I mean, every single community in the world deals with similar issues, but it's important to actually voice the issue in order to kind of tackle it, you know, make sure it never happens again. So that's also a very bold piece. You know,
absolutely. There are a number of really brave pieces in this collection.
Right.
Writers talking about their experiences, as you said, about what are considered taboo subjects in the Arab American community, where people are less comfortable. Mental health is another
one. Yes, mental health is another one.
Those are such important topics to discuss. These are brought out so beautifully and movingly in this collection in a way that's brave and compelling, and but also assertive and creative and thoughtful.
Right.
So I really appreciated that part of the collection.
And there's some touches of humor in some of the essays. So I'm thinking of Yusuf Al-Qamousi's essay, and it's titled Word Man, A Quest for Self-Discovery Through Shakespeare, Tupac, and the Holy Quran.
Yes.
And it's about him navigating, you know, his Muslim identity and how he really has affinity to hip hop, particularly Tupac, and how hip hop kind of led to this love of poetry. There's something very colorful and humorous about that essay too.
Yeah. And the way it brings in all these different dimensions of being Arab American, you know, you don't have to let go, recombine them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's some poets, really established poets, so Hayan Jarada, Junior Mikhail, and there are also other poets, Gamalia Youssef and Yasmin Rukuya. There's also a series of photographs by Rania Matar, the Lebanese American photographer.
Yes.
I remember she came to Dearborn, I think it was in the spring of 2019. I knew Rania Matar from my previous institution, and so she actually stayed with us for a couple of nights in Dearborn.
Nice.
Yeah, and she went out and took photographs of Arab American women, and so we included a series of those photographs in the book. And there's this striking image. I'm flipping through the book, and this speaks to the diversity of, you know, the Arab American community. On page 139, there's a photograph of actually two sisters. I know our listening audience can't see it right now, but they're two sisters, you know, young sisters, maybe in their late teens, early 20s. They're standing outside in Detroit and the wind is blowing. And one sister wears the hijab and the other sister does not. What's really interesting about this photograph is the fact that they're sisters.
Yeah.
It just shows you, you know, even in the same family, there's a diversity of
You
know, experiences and forms of identity.
That's right. And those of us who come from Arab countries, both of us are from Lebanon. We see that, we know that with our families, with our friends, with our neighbors, but it's difficult to convey that here. That's not a very known aspect of our culture.
Right.
So yes, and these are beautiful black and white photographs of women in settings around the community, and they're not your typical setting, right?
Exactly.
And so very interesting work to include here to help us think differently about Dearborn, about being Arab American, about belonging.
Exactly. And, you know, in a way, you know, we were mentioning at the beginning of our conversation about kind of providing a space or a platform for these writers to kind of express their voices. I spoke to some of the women in these pictures who were photographed, and they expressed a lot of gratitude for Rania Matar taking their pictures in a way, you know, telling their own stories through visual images.
Through visual images,
yeah,
absolutely.
So they are also kind of really moved by their interaction with Rania.
Do you know if they got to choose? Like, these are staged photographs, you know? Do you know if there was a process of cooperation, collaboration?
There was, you know, so there's one titled Rebecca, Detroit, Michigan, 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not mistaken, Rebecca and Rania were driving just randomly in Detroit, and they came across the scene. They just walked out. And Rebecca, in this particular shot, Rebecca is facing a wall, right?
Like
a
concrete, away from the camera.
Away from the camera. So her face is turned away from the camera. And Rania said, it just so happened, that wasn't her intention, but it was just this angle that Rebecca just turned and she caught this. She got this
beautiful
image. Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's so compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is an aspect of this that, again, is so beautiful that you incorporated that in this book. And the one of the pieces by Camelia Youssef, Camelia Omeima Youssef, really talks about a family photograph.
Exactly.
Right? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a classic photograph. So this is a photograph, it was taken of her family. So it's from the mid-90s, 1995. Mm-hmm. And it's a picture of Camelia with her family sitting out on the front porch. The family is gathered around these two small coffee tables. There's a pot of tea and the small traditional glass teacups. One family member, he's sitting in the back smoking an argili or a hookah. And what's so compelling about this picture, it's a very, you know, family-oriented picture, but at the same time, this is an image that you really see in Dearborn, especially in the warmer months of the year. People sitting outside on the front porches. I remember the first day that my wife and I came to Dearborn, it was in the summer of 2018. We just actually drove through East Dearborn where this picture was taken, and we saw very similar images such as this one.
Yeah.
And there's just something very communal about it.
Yes. And very family oriented. The shot is in mid shot. Like there's one person in the background gesturing, and like you can tell he's talking. The kids are sitting in the lap. So there's a very family, but also community, as you say.
Right, right.
Yeah, and the iconic Dearborn houses, the
exactly.
bungalows. Yeah.
And you're speaking about the Dearborn houses and the idea of how Arab Dearbornites have Arabized certain spaces in yes. Dearborn. That comes across in Sally Howell's essay, My Dearborn.
Yes.
Where in the essay, she talks about how she and another resident of Dearborn, they go out into Dearborn. There was this competition during Ramadan called Ramadan Lights. And whoever has the quote unquote best Ramadan decorations gets a prize.
Okay.
And it's during, you know, COVID.
Yeah.
And so Sally's essay, it kind of, again, it's speaking about different spaces. And in Ramadan, you know, you really see those decorations all over East Dearborn. Mm-hmm. So her essay, you know, it tackles those spaces, and yeah. it also kind of gives us a history of Dearborn.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's this funny aspect in her essay where she's sort of like a one-upmanship between right. the exactly. Arab local and the historian.
It's really, right.
Whose knowledge is deeper.
Right, right. So the local resident that she's with, he's astonished that Sally knows so much about Dearborn.
Absolutely,
right?
Yes.
And at one point he tells her, who are you?
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And she tells him, well, you know, I am a historian.
Yes.
And at the time she was directing the Center for Arab American
yes.
studies. And so
yes.
she knows the city very intimately.
Yeah. And it kind of speaks to the book of boundary and belonging.
Right.
Right. This question of belonging and who belongs and the different ways of belonging, which I also really appreciated about this. You know, you can belong by being a historian
right.
who is really invested in the community. You can
right.
belong by being an academic working here at the center.
Exactly.
You can belong by having grown up there, or, you know, there are
right.
so many different ways that are represented in this. And that's a really beautiful aspect.
Yeah. I think what comes across also in the essays is that there's no monolithic Arab American experience. I tell my students this, the Arab American students who have grown up here. I mean, I've told them that, you know, their Dearborn experience is so unique. The Arab American experience I had in the DC area was completely different. My sister and I were the only Arabs in school. You know,
yes.
I never had any Arab friends
yes.
after we immigrated from the Arab world.
Yeah.
But here, you know, they have a community. You know,
yeah.
they grew up being surrounded by family members, Arab friends, hookah cafes,
yeah.
Arabic grocery
yeah.
stores and restaurants.
Yeah. Yeah, as a number of essays also illustrate, even Dearborn has changed,
right.
you know, over time. So
and
it's
it
not
keeps
the same,
evolving, right?
Right. Sally's mm-hmm. essay does that.
Mm-hmm.
A number of other essays, the one you mentioned, Yusuf al-Qamusi, I
yes.
think. Yeah. And some others where it's like, Dearborn is different in the 1980s than it is now. And, you know,
right.
2022, and it's a different experience growing up in
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And you show that historical change as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that comes across very nicely. It's not a static, ossified
right.
space.
Exactly.
Very good. You mentioned some of the themes, and I'd like to go back to those
sure.
a little bit. Borders. Well, the title, let's talk about that too, as
mm-hmm.
well as the themes. So the title, you chose an Arabic term, Hadha Baladuna,
yeah.
which means this is our land.
Yes, exactly.
And then Arab American narratives of boundary and belonging. Do you want to talk a little bit about the process of coming up with that title? And then maybe we can talk about the themes, especially boundary and belonging.
Yeah, you know, the publisher, Wednesday University Press, eventually suggested Hadha Baladuna. And we had gone through a series of different titles, such as Arab American Voices, or, you know, we went through a series of titles, but we did want to have some kind of Arabic in it, or transliterated, you know, from Arabic into English. So when the editor suggested Hadha Baladuna, we just jumped on it.
That's great
yeah.
that the editor is the one
right.
who suggested this. Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
A good reader.
Right, right, right. Because, you know, it's such a bilingual city or trilingual even,
yeah.
but you hear Arabic and English everywhere you go in Dearborn.
Yeah.
So I like that it's part of the title too.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah. It's a nice aspect of it. Yeah. And then the themes of boundary and belonging.
Right.
I picked up a few others. There's a lot of generational differences
exactly.
is one of them. So there's that historical change that we touched on, but also
right.
it's a lot about belonging, but it's also about leaving and coming.
Exactly. Right.
There's a lot of that.
Right.
So do you want to talk about some
sure.
of those themes?
Yeah. I think in terms of boundary and belonging, I mean, they both can be true at the same time.
Yeah.
That in terms of belonging, you can feel that you're at home here in Dearborn because, you know, you're surrounded by fellow Arabs. You're speaking Arabic language. There are a lot of Arabized spaces, but also boundary. I mean, at the same time, Dearborn can be insular, and there are also, unfortunately, racial tensions between some of the Arab ethnicities. I know I touched that in my own essay about the way that some Lebanese characters were viewing Yemeni characters quite negatively. I want to stress the some because I don't want to generalize,
absolutely.
But there are those tensions too, and almost like boundary points, right? Like, who does Dearborn really belong to? We were talking about May Jacobowski's essay and Jeff Garoub's essay, how mm-hmm. they also at times felt ostracized for not being Arab enough. So there are a lot of boundaries that are in place with this feelings of belonging.
Right.
Like you said about leaving and coming back. Mm-hmm. I know from just interviewing a lot of Dearbornites, like they have like this love-hate relationship with Dearborn, that everyone knows your business. I want to forge my own path. And yet they'll tell me, oh, but I can't imagine living outside of Dearborn.
Yeah.
Or this pull to kind of always come back. I know Kamalia Youssef, she has a couple of poems in here or prose pieces. And she mentioned, she was born and raised in Dearborn, but then she spent some time in New York and she's itching to kind of come back to this region or to the area. So yeah, there's like this push-pull effect. It's such a unique place too.
Right. And I think that connects to another theme, which is this theme of safety.
Right.
Safety to be Arab, to be Muslim.
Exactly.
But also safe to be different from the conservative norm, that there are these tensions and ideas. And if you want to elaborate on that too.
Yeah, in terms of safety, I mean, it's interesting because I had this one student who told me he feels very, he's an Arab man, he had a big black beard, and he said he feels very safe in Dearborn. The moment he leaves the city, he's kind of on guard because he doesn't know how non-Arabs might perceive him. Mm-hmm. In my essay, I mentioned how there's this a former student of mine, she had this internship in a town near Dearborn, and, this white elderly man spat on her face. Yeah. This was after, I think, 2015 or 2016. And she mentioned that harrowing incident, that the moment she left Dearborn, she didn't feel safe.
Yeah. And she was, in fact, accosted.
Exactly. She was accosted. Exactly. So there's that sense of safety, but also at the same time, Dearborn can also be very conservative. Mm. And you wonder how comfortable does one feel to express themselves, whether it be their queer identity, viewpoints that are contrary to a conservative way of thinking. So I think those are boundaries there too.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. As someone who's, if I may, somebody who's here new, I do see a number of younger people pushing those boundaries or expanding those boundaries.
Right.
A lot more openness about queer identity, for example.
Right.
And a lot more openness about asserting independence as a woman, let's say, and those aspects. And I do see that. One of the things that I appreciate it from the people that I have been talking to is the effort to do it with love.
Right. Yes.
The effort to do it with love. And that's another unique thing that's coming through to me.
Right.
And it comes through in the selections here. Mm-hmm. There might be differences, there might be tensions, but there is for some, for others, different, depending on the level of experience.
Right. And even like sometimes the conservative way of thinking is not necessarily older generations, they're actually even younger generations who are just kind of perpetuating these very old modes of thinking.
Yeah. Some of them not even carried on in our home countries.
That's very true. So I've actually told my students, but I've told them that, Beirut, where I've lived many years, is a lot more open-minded and liberal than Dearborn. There are a lot more queer spaces. There are a lot more, people seem to be more open-minded to many different ways of thinking.
Yeah.
I still think Dearborn has a long way to go.
So that's the interesting thing about having an Arab space like that. But those stories really bring through, even within that, as you called it, a bubble in your piece.
Right.
Even within the bubble, it looks like a bubble, but it's like there are all these different dynamic elements to it that keep it alive. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe we can talk about your piece now.
Sure.
Your title, An Atlas of Homes. I love that title. Can you talk a little bit about that and how it captures so much of what's in your piece?
Yeah. I'm Lebanese and for our family, which is not unique to our family. I think a lot of Lebanese families and Arab families have a similar history in the sense that we've kind of been constantly moving over the course of generations. And, there's a very Western immigration story, which is whether you leave Europe and you arrive in America and that's it. Mm-hmm. It's like a one-way journey. You don't go back.
Yeah.
Where for us, I think it's a bit different. So my great-grandfather left Lebanon in the 1920s. He eventually arrived to the States in West Virginia. And my grandmother and her sister were actually born in West Virginia, but my great-grandfather insisted that they be raised in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. It was like kind of going back and forth.
Right.
I think that kind of going back and forth is quite common, I've found, especially in the Lebanese diaspora, kind of this yearning to go back to the ancestral land despite all the problems that there are over there. And so I tried to capture that through an atlas of homes. Also, because of the Lebanese Civil War, Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 82, it really dispersed so many people everywhere. You know, I actually grew up in Saudi Arabia because, one, the Lebanese Civil War was going on. And then my parents had made a decision to actually return to Beirut right before the Israeli invasion. And then when the invasion happened, they kind of scratched those plans.
Yeah.
And they said, you know what, we'll just stay in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And I think that's true for so many Lebanese, you know, living in the Khalij, Canada, South America. It's political turmoil, you know, drives you out of your home country, but there's always that urge to kind of go back.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something definitely I can relate to in my own experience. And also something I appreciated in your piece where personal decisions, moving here or taking that job there,
right,
are so much motivated by the political circumstance, right, of the time. The history and politics really do shape our lives.
It really does.
And so often the stories are, as you said, like this narrative about it's like go from one here and then they settle there, constantly moving because of circumstances. And even your great grandfather, how you say, you know, from Brazil to
He went to Brazil first, but then he went to the States.
You know, so many of us have like family in South America, family in North America, family in the Gulf region, family in Europe. You know, it's that sort of movement and dispersal and connection. And that comes through really so beautifully in your piece.
Thank you.
Another something that comes beautifully in your piece is the parallels in the different family members' stories.
Right.
And the parallels in the sort of experiences in different generations.
Right.
And it was really beautifully conveyed, but also so striking. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. You know, in our family history, the mother-daughter relationship has been very strong across the board, especially on my mother's side of the family. There are very few men in the family, and there are a lot of really strong women. And now I have two daughters.
Continuing the tradition.
Right. It's just, you know, my grandmother and her sister and my great-grandmother, there were seven children, six girls and one boy. And historically, the men in our family have been very weak, or, you know.
Why would I call it weak?
Well, I mean, but there was a story of my great grandmother. She had a child with her first husband, and her first husband said, speaking about immigration stories, he said, I'm going to try to make it in Argentina. I'm going to sail all the way over to South America to see if I can establish something. Once I do, I'll come back and get you. And he never came back. Mm. I mean, we have no idea what became of him. Wow. And so my great-grandmother was a single mother left in Lebanon. But then my great-grandfather came at that point. He had made himself in America. He ran this cafe. This is really tragic, but he proposed to my great-grandmother, but under the condition that she leave her daughter behind. And she did, which is just shocking. Yeah. She left her first daughter behind and she went back to America. And that same story happened many years later with my own grandmother, where my grandmother had divorced my grandfather. She was living with her three daughters in Lebanon as a single mother. An elderly man, a Lebanese American, came and proposed to her. And it kind of, there's like a, he's 40 years her senior.
Wow.
Yeah. And he kind of gave her a proposal that, you know, I'll take care of your daughters if you marry me. But, and she agreed. And so, you know, she put my mother and my mother's two younger sisters in a boarding school in Beirut, and she left them and she went back, her second husband, to the States. This feeling of abandonment. You know, my grandmother was caught in a really difficult situation. Yeah. She didn't find any other financial way to support her daughters unless she married, you know, her second husband.
Right.
But that idea of kind of abandoning your children kind of runs in our family, but also in the sense of, like we were talking about how a political situation might really change the trajectory of your life. You know, my mother, she was a student at the American University of Beirut, and you know, she talks about those days as like her golden years. Yeah. She was a senior in college, I think, when the Civil War broke out. And it got pretty dangerous in Beirut. And so my grandmother, who was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, just begged her, please come to America. It's not safe there. And so she did. And she just left halfway through her last year in college. She went to her dorm to say goodbye to her friends at AUB, but no one was around.
Yeah.
And so she has always felt that she was kind of ripped out of that world. And something similar happened to my sister and I. You know, I mentioned that we grew up in Saudi Arabia. This was in the 70s and the 80s. And at the time, it wasn't necessarily the easiest. I mean, Saudi Arabia has changed a lot since then. But at the time, it wasn't necessarily easy for women to live there. I remember my sister and I, we were kids and we loved living there. We were at an international school. Our friends were all internationals. We grew like this love for the desert. But then the Gulf War happened. And not many people remember, but I remember... When Iraq actually invaded Kuwait, there was this fear in Saudi Arabia that Saddam Hussein was going to invade Saudi Arabia as well.
Right.
And so my parents just decided, well, let's just leave. We left and we never said goodbye to any of our friends. Yeah. We were actually on summer vacation in DC and my parents decided, let's just stay here. Yeah. So, we literally left everything in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Yeah. You know, there weren't any goodbyes or anything.
Yeah.
And so that idea of always like constant displacement.
Yeah.
And then the family tensions I was talking about between mothers and daughters. Yeah. Has kind of like perpetuated itself.
Yeah. And it shows how certain things that we think of as like individual or idiosyncratic or that family's way of doing things is really just... the circumstances
exactly.
that people find themselves in and what they can do to survive.
Right.
And I was really struck in the heartbreak of abandonment to also provide.
Right. So exactly. It's complicated. Right.
That complicated relationship, which comes through beautifully in your writing. Thank you for being so open about that, because so much of that is not talked about, right? But it is so much part of the experience and the way that politics really impacts individual lives.
It really does. Right.
So we think of war, of like, destroyed buildings is what we see a lot, right? But it's all these subtle ways in which it impacts people's...
Right. I've thought about that a lot. I mean, you know, in terms of like following politics here in the States and then following politics in the Arab world, specifically, you know, for us in Lebanon, politics here definitely affects our lives. If certain constitutional rights are repealed or,
absolutely.
You know, a new president comes in with a very conservative agenda, it does affect our lives. But, you know, in the Arab world, what I found in Lebanon, especially, I mean... Politics literally kills you. It can literally kill you. I mean, it definitely affects you in America, but in a way, it's like you're following it from a distance. But I don't know if that makes
sense. Like it depends. Like this last decision, right? That might be a little bit different.
Exactly.
But you're right. You're right about politics in Lebanon can kill you, right?
If a political leader tells, you know, his followers, you could take to the streets, you know, you never know what might happen.
Unfortunately, right? I feel like more and more this is happening here.
I know that's America's really becoming a very frightening place.
But hopefully there are still enough forces to counteract that and resist that. The other thing that struck me too with this idea of the history and parallelism and repetition, but also how this movement from place. I love the way that you describe your summers in the States when you were still living in Jeddah and you would come to the States to be with your grandmother.
Right.
There's this scene where you describe eating figs from the garden, the figs that were brought from somehow the branch was smuggled from Lebanon replanted in D.C.
Right.
And as I was reading it, it was like, there was Lebanon.
Right.
But in the United States.
Exactly.
And that was such a beautiful thing. And that really, when you went back to Lebanon, it was a different, do you want to talk about a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the summers as a kid, and it was a very romanticized notion of America, right? Because we were just around with my grandmother and my aunts and cousins. So, you know, it was just family. You felt very safe, but at the same time, there were like these, you know, green fields, trees that you don't necessarily see in the desert in Jeddah. Going to the movie theaters, McDonald's, all that stuff. I never felt any kind of alienation because I was always with my family. But of course, that changed when we actually settled in the States. Mm-hmm. About going back to Lebanon, I mean, although I feel that I'm very Lebanese, and this is not unique to my own experience, but you also feel that you're also looked at as an outsider in Lebanon because you haven't necessarily grown up there. Even when I speak Arabic, I can speak Arabic, but I speak it with an accent. So that makes me stand out. So there's always that kind of dilemma, right? You feel that you're very much at home in Lebanon, but you know that you're also, you seem to be like an outsider.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that sort of what makes you Lebanese is the experience of war.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
Which you unfortunately did eventually experience.
The 2006 war. Right. But I remember when we'd spend some summers in Lebanon that everyone had a war story, you know, from my cousins to my aunts about, you know, surviving a sniper's bullet or not having enough water to take a bath or listening to a broadcaster on the radio to know when to venture outside of your home. And I felt as if it was like a rite of passage that to kind of really be Lebanese, you have to have lived through the civil war. And I never had that experience. And then, right, when I was living during the civil war of 2006, you know, it was a very traumatic event. Not event, but time for so many different people. During that moment, I thought, okay, now I'm experiencing it, but there's just something so heartbreaking about it.
You
know, we were safe, you know, we were in Beirut, but we'd hear the reverberations of the bombs, you know? So there really wasn't any glory or satisfaction in experiencing a war story.
Yes. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
There is that sort of glamorization of a war story or a war experience.
Right.
But really, I really appreciate what you're saying.
Right. I mean, I remember that time very vividly because there were two apartments. The whole family members were all packed in these two apartments because other family members were living in other areas of Beirut that were kind of close to targeted areas. Mm-hmm. And we were in Hamra, you know, near the American University of Beirut, which was you know, relatively safe. We were just sitting in front of the TV watching news. There really wasn't a moment where that I felt my life was at risk, except for when actually my sister was getting married at the time in Jordan. And towards the end of the war, I actually evacuated, driving through Syria and then to Jordan. I think the drive on the, you know, Tariq al-Sham, the Beirut Damascus road, that was the one moment where I thought, this is getting a bit dicey. But otherwise, no, I didn't. And you feel safe and comforted in where we were in Beirut. But at the same time, the country is being decimated. Yeah. Bridges are being destroyed. Yeah. Villages in southern Lebanon are just being leveled.
Yeah.
There wasn't any kind of satisfaction in living through that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I appreciate that very much. Bringing it back to Dearborn. Mm-hmm. So then what brought you to Dearborn? And if you can talk a little bit about, also you mentioned your wife's response. And if you could talk about that a little bit,
Right. We came to Dearborn for a job. So there was this opening here at the University of Michigan Dearborn. And I thought to myself, it'd be really interesting to live in an Arab American community. I've never had that experience before. And my wife Fernanda was also kind of excited about that opportunity. But at the time, the summer we moved, Fernanda was still living in Lebanon. We had been maintaining a long distance relationship. We actually hadn't been married yet. You know, Fernanda grew up in Beirut, specifically in the suburb of Dahi, which is kind of like a Shiite enclave. It is kind of dominated by Hezbollah. Like you see Hezbollah flags everywhere. But, you know, she's secular and I don't want to say apolitical, but, you know, she's in tune to many different viewpoints and whatnot. When we came to Dearborn, and she saw a Dearborn, it reminded her a lot of Dahi,
where she's from.
Of the suburb of where she's from. And just to kind of clarify things for our audience, a lot of Lebanese, particularly from southern Lebanon, immigrated to Dearborn, especially after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982.
Right.
So you had a lot of Lebanese, right, from Muslim majority cities and towns in southern Lebanon come to Dearborn. So that's what I think gave the feeling that this is like another Dahi.
Another Dahi. Right? Yeah. Which is great if that, like, that's the I mean, it's interesting historically to think of all of these ways in which places get their identities.
Right.
And what identities they present to the, like, to somebody just coming in, and what's the first look and what's the first feel. And
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And similarly, in our first few months in Dearborn, she felt that, you know, Arabs were always eyeing her at the grocery stores or always asking her, where are you coming from? Why did you come? Are you married? Mm-hmm. And so she told me that it reminded her a lot of the way that people in her neighborhood in Dahi, in Beirut, you know, would always keep an eye on her. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't much privacy.
Right.
So there were those parallels.
And back to that idea of safety and the bubble, that if you know who's around, you take an interest in the person. And so there's a level of, like, including that person in the community, and you're keeping an eye on them, but also you, you're really keeping an eye on them.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. You know, I love the way your piece brings out all of these things, the different paths that different people take to end up here in Dearborn, and the different experiences, and which resonate throughout with the different essays and the different experiences, those who were born here and grew up here, those who came here at a later stage in their lives, and what brought them here, and some of the discussions about how the younger generation, you know, their parents are so appreciative of having a safe place,
right,
you know, away from bombs, away from all of these things, and they could feel safe, feel like they can raise a family. And that's Arab American sort of feeling that they bring to these pieces is really, really lovely.
And that
comes through really nicely here. Well, Ghassan, it's been a pleasure to talk to you about all
of this.
Same
here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's episode was hosted by Pauline Humsey-Vinson. It was produced by Muhammad Jafar and Esma Baban and edited by Muhammad Jafar. Our theme song was composed by Isra Darwish and our logo was created by Maisara Abdelhaq. Scene Jim is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn and the Arab American National Museum. Scene Jim is funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn. Check out our website, scenejimpodcast.org, for more information on our guests and to view videos of their readings. Thank you for listening.